From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft Extended Edition. I am your host, Doug Dangler. If you've joined me on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. during our regular time slot, you know that we've got five-minute excerpts of some of the longer interviews that I've done. And today, Dan Michalko, station manager, has been kind enough to let me experiment with a longer format, an hour-long format that will bring some interesting new voices, some expanded ideas, and longer treatments than I can normally do in the 5 minutes. So here we go. Today, we will be featuring Tony Cochran, the artist and writer for the syndicated cartoon comic strip Agnes, New York Times best-selling author, and a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, PJ O'Rourke. We will also be joined by blogger and author Sarah Barron, and native Ohioan Dan Wilbur will join me to talk about his book and his humor writing. The very fine Andrew Hudgens from The Ohio State University will be here to discuss humor and what led him into a life of telling jokes. And Jim C. Hines, a humor and fantasy writer, will be telling me about both of those worlds. I've had the opportunity in the past 5 years to interview hundreds of different people about writing and creativity, generally people who are doing it professionally, making their livelihoods at it. It's been fascinating for me because I get to see their creativity. I get to ask them questions about it that I ordinarily wouldn't, because my standard line is that I was raised in the Midwest and you were taught to not ask questions like that. But I've been able to ask those questions and it's been a learning experience. One of the areas that I find most interesting is when I get to talk to people who are funny for a living. And this has run the gamut of all kinds of different folks, a lot of the fine people that come through the Thurber House and a lot of people at the Ohio Anna Book Festival. Funny people have always been inherently more interesting to me because I like the way that a funny mind or creative mind approaches a problem, because it's that turn at the end that you don't expect, that twist and that ability to make that twist work, that is the most interesting thing to me. I love all kinds of creativity. I'm fascinated by design. I can't do any variety of drawing or art, painting. I can't dance. But I can remember jokes, tell jokes, and approximate enough timing that it will work. And that was some of the great things that I got to figure out with the people in this broadcast, some of the funny folks that I've talked to recently about how they got started into a life in which they're basically trying to make you laugh and to exert that kind of control over folks. One of the things that always fascinates me about funny, about people who are funny, is what makes it funny. You know, what's the genesis of comedy and why? So that was a common question that I asked the people I'm talking to today, to get their sense of what's funny, how they gauge what's funny, because a lot of times I'll laugh at something and tell somebody else, and oftentimes I'll be met with a look of either confusion, possible disgust. The emotions run the gamut. And I'd like to know, with people who make their living through comedy, what's funny to them?
Every day in the Dispatch and newspapers around the country, Tony Cochran shows what's funny in his comic strip, Agnes. And so during our talk about what's funny, that was one of the first things I asked him, because if you've got to produce a comic strip every day, you must do a lot of thinking about what's funny and why it's funny and how you're possibly going to keep coming up with things that are funny over and over and over. So here's what Tony Cochran had to say.
Walk me through maybe a couple of examples of how you've said, all right, this is funny or this isn't funny. I'm just trying to delve into the mind of Tony Cochran and find out here where that kind of experience happens, where that the funny or not funny. Maybe give me a couple of rejected recent strip or something like that, if you're willing to open up the cabinet and show the magic behind it.
No, not really. I'm not going to do that. But you know what? It's like this. I write it all in a little loose leaf notebook. I'm very, very analog. I don't do anything high tech. In fact, Skype is intimidating to me. But I write it all out in longhand with pencil, and I have stacks and stacks and stacks of these that I filled up. And I'll just put the beginning and the middle and leave the the setup. I'll put a wonderful setup, and I can't figure out how to close the setup because you only have like a space of a few seconds. If you have anybody's attention at all anymore in the newspapers, reading a comic strip, which has already narrowed your field down, and then you narrow it down to the people who actually read your comic strip, you only got a brief, maybe 10 seconds at the most for somebody who will devote to reading your strip. It's not like, you know, they're sitting down with Hemingway and going to devote a good portion of their life to finishing a novel. They want to laugh and they want to, and then move on to something else. And right at that point, they decide after they read it whether it's a disappointment or not. Now, I have, as you can tell by this interview, I have a tendency to get a little wordy and talk too much. So I have to pare the words down, and then I have to pare the joke down. There can't be a huge leap. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There can't be. You can't jump from. You can't expect everybody to be able to leap the same cliffs to humor that I do. Not that it's a huge leap for me or that I can leap so much better than anybody else, but my mind operates during in a different synaptical pattern than other people. And the humor tends to appeal to people who have the same synaptical pattern. And I don't even know if that's a word, but that's something I find amusing. So there you go.
Okay. Now, I've read that you usually talk to your wife about the what's funny or not funny on the strip. That's from an interview in, I think, 2006. Is that something that you still do? Is she still willing to look at the strip?
Yeah, she actually likes to look at it. She gets first shot at all of them.
Mm-hmm.
She still finds me humorous. I don't know if she does that because, you know, she's just being kind. But I actually find her laughing at them when I'm not in the room. So. I guess she's not lying to me.
Yeah.
And she'll tell me. She'll say, Tony, read this one again and tell me what you think. And I'll read it and I'll say, well, I think it's funny. She'll say, well, yeah, but, you know, and she'll kind of lead me back down to a easier, more discernible humor.
Okay. Now, I read in that same interview in 2006 that you picked Dondi as one of your favorite strips from when you were young, as mm-hmm. maybe a formative influence, which seems, like you say in the essay, it's kind of a sad strip. It isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't a laugh a minute, Dondi. From what I remember of it, doesn't that take place in World War II or something like that? Am I confusing that strip with another one?
No, I wish I had the masterwork of Dondi. It was one of the comics I read when I was a kid that influenced me into being comics. It wasn't funny at all. It mm-hmm. was about an orphan kid and being raised by GIs or something. And he had little dots for eyes, and he was pathetic all the time. It was always a pathetic little story. And I try to absorb some of the patheticism, which is another word. I don't know whether it's a word or not, but that's what I'm playing with this week.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what I'm trying to do is figure out what I'm going to do. I get to be a speaker at the Irma Bombeck Conference on Humor this year. And, I it's hard for me to talk in front of people. I used to be able to talk in front of people all the time, and now I'm just embarrassed to do it. And so I'm trying to find something I can talk about without stumbling and make it sound like I make sense. It's about the same thing. What is funny and what is not funny.
P.G. O'Rourke has been writing for many, many years, starting out with the National Lampoon and going into a number of books and many, many articles, reporting from hotspots around the world as a political reporter. P.G. O'Rourke's writing also introduced me into the idea of personal politics. My first year of graduate school, I took a course with a well-known instructor who had an essay collection with two of P.G. O'Rourke's essays in it. One day during class, I said, I really like your book because it has many different points of view in it, including P.G. O'Rourke, whose writing I like, and you have two of his. And she fixed her eye upon me and said, well, I'm glad you like him because I don't. That was my co-editor's choice. There were two essays in the first edition, one in the second edition, and if I have anything to do about it, there won't be any in the third edition. That's when I learned that politics at a university are a blood sport. So here's P.J. O'Rourke.
Do you have, as you're writing, and you're doing humor writing, a particular test for yourself to say, I think this is really funny, or I don't think this is funny. How do you proceed through humor? Because you started off doing, I think, stuff for the National Lampoon.
I did, yeah. That was like my first like real job in the early 70s, 40 years ago now. Although I've been writing some humorous stuff before that.
Yeah. So you've got things, Holidays in Hell, where you've gone to conflict spots that there's a lot of things that I think it must be difficult sometimes to look at things and find humor and find the absurdity. I'm certainly they're absurd and crazy situations, but, you know, what is there that you say, this is something that I can work with, or this is something that's taboo, this is something that's funny, this is something that isn't?
It's very hard to articulate that, mm-hmm. and I think really the easiest way for me to explain it is that I come from a large Irish family, and there are famously two kinds of Irish families. There's the teasing kind and the hitting kind. And if you are lucky, you get the teasing
kind. I've never heard that distinction. I'm not Irish, though.
Yeah.
So
I tell for me, not only am I Irish, but so is my wife, and my father-in-law is first generation. And my family very much belonged to the teasing kind, as I'm glad to say it is my wife's family. And that's the way all emotions were expressed in my family, love, anger, embarrassment, criticism, praise. Everything was expressed by teasing. By making jokes, everything but the most horrible. I mean, it would take something like the death of a child or something to get the O'Rourkes to be serious.
Okay.
And so it was just a mode of communication that I grew up with, and I think that I've generally trusted my instincts. I suppose there were some times at the like at the National Lampoon when we were trying to shock for shock's sake, and I wouldn't look back at that as some of that stuff is my proudest moment, but fundamentally I've just sort of gone with my gut, and it's proved moderately trustworthy.
Jim C. Hines has written several best-selling fantasy books, all of them which have a great deal of humor in them, such as the Goblin Quest fantasy trilogy with Goblin Quest, Goblin Hero, and Goblin War. He's also a popular blogger and Twitterer. In this exchange, we comment on C.C. Finley, who is also an avid Twitterer and fantasy writer, who happened to have introduced the two of us.
So what led you into the idea of, you're going along, you're writing a story, and you think, I like these humorous elements of it. Let me see if I can get away with it, or what led into that?
Part of what led into it is, you know, that book actually sold, and so, you know, I like money, and
right.
I was, I will do more of that then. But partly, you know, as I kept writing and I kept learning and I started to get a little bit more confident, I started getting away from that idea of writing what you're supposed to write or trying to write what the market wants or chasing that idea of this is what a good writer should write, and started worrying more about what do I want to write, what makes me happy, what makes me laugh, what makes me feel good about, you know, what I've done by at the end of the day. And for me, that's humor. Not always, but a lot of the time, if I can make people laugh, that's been a good day. That's what I want to do.
Okay. Now, what's your gold standard or for making people laugh? What do you look for? What do you, as you're writing, say, hey, I think this is funny? I know it's a gut instinct, but are there times when you come back and say, you know, I thought this was funny when I wrote it, but it's just not working for me for some reason? Have you been able to figure out what that kind of experience is for you so that you, obviously you can replicate it, but how is that developed for you, that ability to figure out what's funny and what's not funny?
You know, I still go back, I reread things in draft form, and I'd say probably half the jokes or the things that I put in that first draft because I thought, oh, this is hilarious, I read it in the revision and, oh Lord, what was I thinking? Thank God that I can just delete this out of there. Mm-hmm. I did it on Twitter about a half hour ago. So, this is going to be funny. This is going to be great. This is Oh, God, don't click send. Everybody will laugh at you. It will be bad. Mm-hmm. They will ban you from Twitter.
You know, if you did get banned for Twitter from a bad joke, I don't think there'd be anyone left on Twitter. Is my guess.
Oh, Finlay would still be on there making his puns.
Yeah. He's a big fan of puns.
One of the other things that I've tried is just running some of the material by other people. And the other night, I was sitting at dinner with my family, and I was talking about a scene I had just written with this little monster-type character. And, you know, I've moved on. This wasn't a nose-picking joke. This was now a fart joke.
Oh, good, good.
Because I'm moving up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell the scene, and my wife just gives me a look. And my daughter, who is 13, it's pretty much the same look. It's almost spooky.
Mm-hmm. It's genetic.
And my 8-year-old son laughs so hard that he spits milk all over his dinner. And so I looked at that and figured, okay, this works.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take it.
That is a heartwarming family story.
Sarah Baron's latest book, The Harm in Asking, My Clumsy Encounters with the Human Race, follows some of her unusual interactions with other people, and we talked about what kinds of things she finds funny, what is off-limits, what isn't off-limits, how she delivers her material, and what makes her think twice when writing humor.
So tell me, on the book, The Harm in Asking, what is the area or the essay that you got done writing and said, this is the one that I want to share the most, and that you might have called up somebody? I'm curious because I think that says a lot about a writer in terms of, you know, who they are. Because whenever I have something really good, in the two times that's ever happened, I've wanted to call somebody and say, hey, listen to this, and then read it to them to gauge the reaction.
That's a really good question, and I think you're right. I think that is very revealing. I weirdly, based on so much of the stuff that we've just been talking about, like, I'm a very private writer, so I am very unwilling to share, and it's only been in the second book that I've even been able to show it to anyone other than my editor. So I just say that to say that that's a point, a place that I get to very rarely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the last chapters in my book is called "This Might Be Controversial," and what it is about, the sort of the hanger on which I've hung the chapter, is about my experience as a teacher. And "This Might Be Controversial" is this game that comes up in this one writing class that I had. That was sort of about everybody getting into this habit of saying out loud, like, whatever their worst private thought was. And, I assume that some people will find that chapter offensive, but I don't like reading it when I, you know, I always try and read stuff aloud to myself when I'm done. And I felt like it had some of the most like jokes per minute in a way. And I liked it for that reason. And then one of the other ones that again, not saying any of these are that amazing, but one of the ones that felt good to me when it was done was, there's a chapter in the book called "The Stupid Step Out," which is about my family. My parents had kids somewhat late in life, and neither my younger brother nor myself have had children yet. And I'm 35 and he's 31. So we're sort of this gang of four with no grandchildren, and we do all these activities together, and they're very depressing because they're all screaming for grandchildren when in fact they're up for grandchildren.
Right.
It's like, let's the four of us go to the beach. Let's the four of us go to the 4th of July parade. Let's the four of us go mini golfing, which is like sweet when my brother and I are teenagers, but is really pathetic at this point. And that was an idea that hit me once, you know, a few years ago when I was home. And I thought, there's something in that. There's a chapter in that somewhere. And it was hard to get it to what I thought was like a readable 15 pages. And so I just kind of felt personally accomplished in that regard, I think.
Well, I think that you're underselling the family thing here. I just want to throw this out there because, and people can read the book, there's a reason why the family did it that I thought was a really nice background to it, that, you know, there were some significant reasons why that all occurred.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's not simply the family that can't bear to do anything by themselves or something like that.
No, no, definitely. At this point, we run the other way when my mother calls. I'm just kidding.
Andrew Hudgens is a professor at The Ohio State University and author of multiple books of poetry and two, and counting, treatments of humor, with his latest called The Joker, which chronicles his youth and growing up and learning about the world in large part through jokes and humor.
If you could define for us in maybe a sentence, what's funny to everybody? And we'll go from there.
I don't know what's funny to everybody. If you look at joke books, I would think that if you laughed at 20% of the jokes in a joke book, that was a fabulously successful joke book. But I suspect nobody's going to laugh at the same 20.
Right. Yeah, that was a horribly unfair question. I know that right off the bat. I just wanted to put you at ease to let you know. So you've got a new book called The Joker, a relatively new book, and it details the way that you grew up and had a sense of humor and developed your sense of humor. So tell me a little bit more about that, please.
I learned things from jokes. Mine was a family where my parents were very quiet. They didn't explain things about sex. So I learned about sex from hearing jokes that I didn't understand. And I also learned about racism from hearing jokes from my grandparents, certainly not from my father, but my mother would tell jokes that she had heard from my uncle. And so I was being instructed, you know, both for good and for ill through jokes.
Okay. So you, in this book, go through a lot of these jokes and try to work out sort of their impact on you, how you learned, and that how they formed the bedrock for your sense of humor, right?
Yes.
So what did you learn about yourself as you were writing the book that maybe came as a surprise? I mean, you may have started with one thing and wrote your way into a different viewpoint.
Absolutely. One of the things that we're aware of about jokes and humor is that there's often an ugly side to it. And I think a lot of people are censorious about jokes because they see the aggression or the transmuted anger of jokes. But I would argue that transmuted is the key word, that it changes sometimes something that can be aggressive or angry and turns it on its head, a kind of linguistic judo.
Author, actor, and stand-up comedian Dan Wilber's first book, How Not to Read, was one of the many fine books at the Ohioana Book Festival in spring 2013, where I interviewed him the first time. Our full interview at craftheshow.com describes in detail Dan Wilber's ideas of what's funny, what isn't funny, and how you have to reveal who you are as a person if you're going to be taken seriously as a comic.
Have you been able to categorize that this will work on stage versus this will work on Twitter? Differentiation in humor? Is there a way that you can tell those of us humor impaired, as my family has described me, to be able to know the difference, although I'm not on stage?
Well, actually, I think it's more, it's nicer to be on stage because you can't just, elevate your writing, right? You can't just read tweets, even if they're the funniest jokes in the world, and they're the most well-crafted jokes in the world. If you just read them to somebody and you're not present, your stand-up's going to suck. So the good thing about stand-up is that you can sort of get away with, I wouldn't call it lazy writing. You should never be lazy. But if you're just doing setup punch, setup punch, setup punch, and you never actually reveal anything about yourself, you never say anything that makes people relate to you, it can be really, it'll be your downfall when you're on stage. Because you have to open up. You have to be present. Whereas Twitter, if you just write a line, 140 characters, that's got a real turn in it, you know, like a real piece of misdirection, like, you know, just pick any optimistic quote and change one letter of it or something. Just like a really easy turn that's like a parody of other people's old genuine thoughts, genuine pieces of advice. If you can turn that into a joke and you can do that 16 times a day, you'll be like the most famous person on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not. I mean, I just think that everything that I've done, there was a thing on Reddit called stand-up shots where you put your jokes next to your face. And if I had put my jokes that are like my opener about what I look like and where I went to school and what I did, you know, they're all jokes, but they're more about getting the audience comfortable very quick with what they're looking at versus like writing a joke about the Cleveland Browns football helmet is just a helmet where the other NFL teams get ferocious animals and, you know, their logo saying, hey, our team's going to come to your town, we're going to kill you, and then we're going to burn down your house. And the Browns logo is basically saying safety first. Like, that's like a, it's like a joke with like I shortened that up. I just said it wrong. I just butchered my own joke. But I shortened that up into a tweet-sized joke about the football helmet and then this and then ferocious animals and then the punch, whatever. And I can still do it on stage, but like I have to do, I have to be mad at the Browns. I have to like, you have to come up with some kind of energy that you're not just saying those words, mm-hmm. like deadpan. Sorry, I just answered like 8 questions that of my own instead of answering your question. But basically, like if you can write jokes with turns in them, and I keep saying turns, but I just mean misdirection. If you can do like misdirection really well, you could just write 1,000 tweets tomorrow and post them. But you'll never be a good stand-up until you can do something that's relatable and mm-hmm. likable, and then add those pieces of misdirection into the story of what you're all about on stage, which is way harder. It's easier to say that because you're like, yeah, you just get to talk, but it takes like people 20 years to figure out how to just talk on stage and be funny.
Like Dan Wilber, Sarah Baron had many similar ideas about revealing yourself when writing or doing any variety of craft that involves humor.
It's wonderful to talk to you and to talk to you about your new book, The Harm in Asking, My Clumsy Encounters with the Human Race, which sounds like you've got some problems to discuss.
Well, that is why my therapist is a very rich woman. She's rolling in it just because of me and all my dysfunction. Lucky lady.
Yeah, that's. It's always good to find that one person you can name a syndrome after.
Yes, exactly. I could be that person.
Well,
Sarah Baron syndrome.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
Then you can go down in history. So tell me about your new book. It's a collection of essays, self-revealing essays about some of the difficulties you've had, as the subtitle goes, My Clumsy Encounters with the Human Race.
Yes, it's it is intended. I always feel very obnoxious when I say that it's supposed to be like a funny book because I don't know if anyone will find it funny. So I mean that I intend for it to be a funny book. And it is arranged for the most part chronologically from the time I was a kid until my very recent history, and is divided into 4 sections, sort of childhood and then a section I called Renegade, which is about various misguided and unsuccessful attempts to rebel. And then a section called Roommates, which is, I have lived mostly in New York City, and anyone who has done that or lived in any other major city, of course, most of us cannot afford to live alone. And so it's about sort of charting that horrible territory. And then the last section is sort of a, if I'm being totally honest, a bit of a hodgepodge of some different odds and ends about which I thought, I hope this can still be funny and serve as a worthwhile conclusion to the book. So I don't know if that worked, but I hope that it did.
Okay. Well, tell me about writing it. These all happened at different times in your life, but you approached them, I'm guessing, in a certain period of time in which you said, I'm either going to collect all these essays or I'm going to write the ones that really stick with me and move forward. How did that writing process work for you?
Well, I found this was my second book, and it was similar to the first insofar as it is an essay collection. It isn't quite a memoir insofar as it's sort of one long story. So, and it's also not an essay collection that was built around a bunch of freelance pieces that I wrote over the course of the years and then just sort of put together. So in my experience with both books, you sort of start out thinking that it's going to be one thing. And you'll do this, and you'll do this story, and this will work great, and this is a brilliant idea, and whatever. And then years go by during which you write that book, and it winds up being a very different thing based on what really turns itself, what does turn out to be workable, or things that happen to you while you're writing, and you think, oh, okay, that could kind of work in this way or that way. So it's always this sort of work in progress until one day you're like, oh my God, it's done. And I hope it's at least vaguely amusing.
Interestingly, Sarah Baron's idea of the slow accretion of text becoming a book isn't all that different from somebody like P.J. O'Rourke, who's written a number of books. And his latest, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again, shares a somewhat similar origin story in how P.J. O'Rourke put the book together.
So tell me, P.J. O'Rourke, the third subtitle of your book claims that you'll never do it again, this baby boom thing that you're talking about in this latest book. How can we be sure?
Oh, I think age alone. You know, I'm 66, so it's pretty unlikely that I'm going to do any of that stuff over again.
Well, tell me about this book. It encapsulates, or it goes back to talk to a little bit about your background, your history growing up as part of the baby boom generation, and you're splitting it up into the freshmen, the juniors, the sophomores, the seniors.
I was trying to deal with, 75, there are 75 million baby boomers,
mm-hmm.
and I was trying to sort them out. You can't sort them out by race, class, gender, or sexual orientation. That would be offensive to baby boom sensibilities. So I was trying to figure out you can't talk about all these people aren't the same, So I thought, but we're the generation that never grew up, so let's sort them by high school class.
Right.
And so that's what I ended up doing, which was, I'm a senior. I was born right after the war. And we were a pretty wild generation. But arguably, the juniors who were born in the early 50s, our little brothers and sisters, were even wilder because we were the oldest baby boomers. We were, the way I put it in the books, we were on the bow wave of the baby boom journey of exploration. Yet at the same time, we're tethered very closely to the prior generation, the greatest generation, and so what happened to us is we got keel-hauled, basically. We got dragged under the hull, So mm-hmm. we're a little shaky at times, I think I can explain it most easily by saying that both Cheech of Cheech and Chong and Hillary Clinton are members of the senior class of the mm-hmm. baby boom. It kind of covers the gamut,
Right, yeah.
Yeah, then the juniors are like a little looser and wilder. I mean, they're actually the barefoot urchins in Haight-Ashbury and the groupies and all that. And now eventually they found some shoes and made their way to Silicon Valley because mm-hmm. Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, both born in 1955. They never did find their neckties, I noticed. But anyway, they're the real sort of cutting edge of the baby boom, certain ways. Then you have your sophomore class. This is a little backed off. That's the preppy handbook group.
Uh-huh.
And then you have the freshman class, to which our president belongs. And they just sort of take the whole baby boom universe for granted. That's just the way the world has always been. You know, they don't have any visceral memories of the things that shaped the baby boom. You know, I mean, the things like the war in Vietnam. I mean, to them, if they remembered at all, it was just something that was always on television all the time, you know, for no reason you could quite figure out, sort of like Ed McMahon, you know. and feminism had gone from this pressing social issue to this TV comedy, Maude, you know, that their parents liked, and Martin Luther King was a day off from work, you know. I mean, they just sort of didn't, you know, they just think the world the way it is now is the way it always has been.
It's funny, you're putting these into like the younger siblings and everything. My older siblings were more firmly rooted in some of the baby boom, and so I blame them.
Oh yeah, see, but by the time you came along, like yes, you accepted sex, drugs, and rock and roll and the deep philosophical underpinnings thereof, you know. But you'd also seen enough of the baby boom in action to realize that, you know, what works in general principles doesn't always work when the bong sets the beanbag chair on fire.
Right. And you know, even though I may have accepted sex, drugs, and rock and roll, none of those things really accepted me for much longer periods of time than I think most everybody else in that area. So I feel a certain amount of distance from it.
No discussion of humor writing would be complete without a sample joke to be analyzed in much the same way that Sigmund Freud analyzed humor and killed it. So with that as the background, here is a joke from Andrew Hudgens.
You're often in a mature vein with your humor. Do you have a radio-friendly joke?
A radio-friendly joke. Here's one that I've been laughing at a little bit. This frog is very lonely. He's particularly lonely for female companionship. So he goes to a fortune teller, and he asks the fortune teller if he will meet a young woman. And she looks into her crystal ball, and she tells him, "Yes, you will." And he says to the fortune teller, "Is she young and beautiful?" And the fortune teller says, "Yes, she is young and beautiful." And the frog said, "Where will I meet her? Will I meet her in a bar? Will I meet her in a disco?" "No," she says, "you'll meet her in a biology class."
Very nice. Very nice.
I love that joke.
What is it that you love about that joke?
Well, it plays around with a lot of our, you know, we accept that the frog would be looking for a woman because we know there are women who are longing to kiss frogs and turn them into handsome princes. We grew up on that fairy tale. So that takes our expectation and completely changes the concept our conceptions around. And so it's playing with us. It's teasing with us. At another level, it's taking that, and I think one of the bedrock points here is the frog is a frog.
Right.
He wants to be a man. He wants to have a wider view of the world. But ultimately, this joke is going, if you're a frog, you're a frog.
Not surprisingly, Dan Wilbur had a lot of thoughts about what humor writing is. And it was great that he was willing to share those with me and talk about what his process is and the kinds of things that he sets up for himself to do as a humor writer.
So how is it going in the Twitter business? How is that treating you?
Let me tell you, I just nailed it this afternoon. I was playing Dark Souls 2, which just came out, and I read somewhere that the internet turned 25 yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started writing a bunch of tweets that said, "The internet turned 25, dot, dot, dot," which means, and then just filled in all the things that are things a 25-year-old do that only have to do with the internet. Like, the internet turned 25, which is why I can give you advice on beating any video game in the world, but it had problems when healthcare started. It didn't really understand it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a great 25-year-old millennial/internet joke. except it's not really that funny. Like, I'll probably never tell it on stage unless I do like a Letterman kind of, you know, top 10 reasons the internet is 25. That's not what Letterman sounds like. But I like Twitter as a space to experiment with one joke format over and over and over. Like one day I did, I only tweeted for the entire 24 hours that I was tweeting that day. I started every sentence with the best. And so it started to get, it went from like, you know, the best meal I ever had was at this place and it was a joke. And then it got to like the best man at a wedding is this. And that was a joke. And then finally I was doing, I was doing like the jokes that started with the best man holiday was robbed at the BAFTAs. It should have gotten more awards. And I just kept experimenting with basically with nothing different. I just stuck to one idea. So if I could do all day, the internet turned 25, even though it happened yesterday, and it's the World Wide Web that turned 25, not the internet. If I could do them all day, just that joke format, I bet I could do it. I bet I could do maybe 60 tweets.
Okay.
I bet people would enjoy that.
Do you set humor writing goals for yourself like that? Like, today I'm only going to experiment with this format, or today I'm only going to write X as a way to jumpstart creativity? Because, you know, if you put limits on yourself, then you're going to, you know, push against those limits. Is that a conscious decision?
What I do is, it's usually organic when it's Twitter. And in fact, all the joke writing that I do in a journal and everything else is usually pretty organic. I have no real writer's block. I have to write down who I'm going to email that day and what jobs I'm going to actually go out for and what projects I'm actually going to finish that are sort of tangential to stand-up, because the stand-up thing is just like, it's pure joy for me. And I know that's probably not true. I probably spend a lot of time complaining about stand-up and the process of stand-up and how I can't write bits and I feel like a nowhere man. But for the most part, the only thing I have to write down that's inorganic is like a list of you need to email so-and-so because otherwise you'll never make it. Or you need to get like headshots like today, or you should have gotten them last month, or like you need to schedule an appointment with the dentist to look at your teeth, you know, stuff like that. It sounds very vain and it sounds really not funny, but that's part of being a lazy comedian, is that you have to write down, it's usually about 4 or 5 hours of work you have to spend really trying to get yourself out there. And then as far as getting in the mood to write stand-up and jokes and tweets, I mean, it's just anywhere now.
Okay.
I'm walking around, I'm in the subway, I'm in my room, I'm in bed, and I can't sleep. I'm writing jokes.
So like Dan Wilbur, the other humor writers that I talked to were great about offering advice about where to write, how to write, and what your career expectations might be. And Jim C. Hines offered some insight into where humor writing is going and the kinds of things he's experienced in his career.
What is the thing that you've learned as you've progressed through your writing and changed that has helped you the most that you can point to maybe for younger writers getting started and say, you know, this is really important? You know, like some people think that you must read constantly and learn from other people. Is that maybe one of them, or is there something more powerful for you?
Reading is definitely good. One of the more powerful ones for me has been just being willing to fail. There's a story I wrote last year for an anthology called Unidentified Funny Objects 2, which is a collection of humorous science fiction and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And the editor, Alex, had invited me to write a story for this thing. And so I'm sitting there saying, okay, right, be funny. And ended up deciding I want to write a humorous story about a terminal cancer patient.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not the setup you really expect. Go on.
No, I think my brain hates me. But, you know, and I went into it knowing full well there was a good chance that I was going to fail, that this might not work. I might not be able to pull this all together and do what I want the story to do. But given the choice between going to write something safe, you know, just sort of recycle something I've already done, or let's try this new thing, trying to push yourself, you know, trying to write those stories that scare you because you're not sure you can do it or not, I think that's where I've ended up producing some of the stuff I'm most proud of.
Is that story, did that end really, really well for you? I mean, if it's in the anthology, right?
I am very happy with how it ended up. There was a fair amount of gnashing of teeth and, you know, pounding my head on the desk in the process of writing it. But I've had a number of people who read it who, you know, they have close family members who are struggling cancer, or they had lost somebody to cancer. And pretty universally, their response has been, yes, you got it. I had one person who took a copy of the story and brought it to read to her father, who was actually struggling with cancer at the time, because she thought this would make him laugh, this take on it. And honestly, I don't know if I've ever gotten a better compliment than that.
P.J. O'Rourke's take on being a comedy writer in the current economic climate was perhaps not surprising, but still very helpful. I know that you get this all the time, but do you have any advice for people who are sort of starting out their careers in writing? The landscape has changed a lot, I think.
Other than don't. I mean, you know, there's a huge problem here is that I was a writer for 40 years. I was a writer, and now I'm a content provider. And the entire message of the internet is that content is free. So you can see the problems of that as an economic model.
Right.
It's not an easy thing to do, and it doesn't pay as well as it once did. And I think basically go to law school is my. You know, there are always going to be laws being violated.
Perhaps it's an occupational hazard of the poor economics of writing, or maybe it's just something that writers are drawn to, but happiness and humor writing don't seem to go together, at least with the people I talk to. Agnes cartoonist Tony Cochran made this point during our talk right after we discussed Peanuts creator Charles Schulz and Funky Winkerbean creator Tom Baddick. I like to think maybe of cartoonists as being more happy-go-lucky. Is that your experience? Although I know Charles Schulz wasn't necessarily a happy-go-lucky guy.
No, he was a miserable guy. He was unhappy. Even after he was a millionaire, he was unhappy. I guarantee you, if I made $1 million out of this, I'd be a happy camper. Probably ruin my strip. But he never was pleased with the way his life was turning out. And I don't even think Tom Baddick's a very happy guy. I mean, I've met him a couple times, and he always seemed kind of melancholy. Speaking of his storyline about breast cancer, my wife developed breast cancer 2 years ago, and so I lived it, you know. And yeah. and we developed between us a particular brand of dark humor, which got us through 90% of that, and then a lighter brand of more of grayish humor that goes through the other 10%. Mm-hmm. It's a great tool, you know, to keep yourself laughing. But I've always maintained that laughter is about maybe a quarter inch from crying, and crying is about a quarter inch from laughing. That's why a really, really good laugh can dissolve into tears at any moment, right, as far as I'm concerned.
Does that mean that as you're writing the strip, sometimes you feel really close to sadness in that way? Is that something that comes through just for you, or do you feel like that may be part of why the strip is set in an economically depressed area with a girl who's not wealthy and living without her parents?
No, I think I'm cursed with the sadness. Is kind of like the mud vein in my carpness. You know, I just born with it. It's kind of you know, I have flashes of happiness. I don't want to make it out like I'm some kind of depresso guy. But if I was really, really happy all the time, I don't find a whole lot of humor in that. You know, right. I mean, name the last happy comedian you thought was funny.
Dan Wilbur and I talked even more about the connection between misery and comedy and whether they're two sides of the same coin and how that impacts his work as a comedian.
I was talking to somebody about comics, and I said, well, is it really all about the pain? Who is it bring the pain? I can't remember the comics that's the name of somebody's set. And, you know, we were then talking about, well, who do you think is the most well-adjusted comic? And somebody like Jerry Seinfeld, maybe.
Yeah.
Seems more adjusted, whereas there are people that, you know, there are people with all the addictions. How many have died from addictions, which seems to me to be a way maybe of dealing with pain. It's a double-edged sword. You know, you have the ability to deal with the pain on stage, but that ability may awaken something, or it's just a part of the personality.
Jerry Seinfeld, in an interview, admitted, why am I saying that? He was just in the New York Times. I mean, he didn't get married until he was like 56, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's an old dad. We all got problems. We all got issues. Whether it's like, you know, it doesn't have to be cocaine. And I think because Seinfeld had a vision of being squeaky clean, and or not squeaky clean, but at least clean enough that he doesn't curse. He doesn't. He tries to make his set something that you can show to, like, your grandma if you wanted to,
mm-hmm.
Which is really admirable. And yet, yeah, I don't think he really, if I see a comic who's doing that, who doesn't open up that much about marriage, you know, like anytime Seinfeld talks about marriage, he's talking in general. He's saying men are like this, women are like this. I have this idea, I have that idea. He's never like, I did this with my wife and kids. It's never like Louis C.K., who seems to always be like bleeding for the art.
Bleeding,
as Hemingway would have it.
Yeah, bleeding for your enjoyment.
Bleeding for your enjoyment. I mean, that there had to be years where Seinfeld was, I mean, where C.K. was miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the most, I saw Chewed Up live, it was like 6 years ago, 7 years ago,
mm-hmm.
which is all about they're jokes that are extremely personal about his wife. And at the time of his recording it, they must have already been getting divorced. I know this sounds like, I'm not trying to make it juicy, but it's weird that he's talking about, like, I mean, I think the end joke is about this is when you become a real woman and this is when you become a real man. And it's a very personal story about, like, walking in on his wife in the shower. And yet, you know, now in retrospect, that they must have been getting divorced. And yet there's nothing about divorce. And mm-hmm. then all the other stand-up specials are about divorce later. It's so, like, mind-boggling. So I think there's just, you'll never really know what a comic is like. It's...
Of all the humorists that I talked to for this special, perhaps Sarah Baron's stories are the most self-revealing and the ones that interestingly prodded the limits of comedy. If you read some of the reviews of her work on Amazon, she gets equal parts praise for talking about herself and condemnation for talking about things that there are various people who would like to not hear about. We don't discuss any of the particular topics in the final excerpt in this special, but I liked what she had to say about how she approaches her writing
to make it interesting and tread that line between too much and just enough. Tell me about when you're writing these. These are very, I said revealing. There's some of them that talk about some, how can I put this?
Tawdry subjects, shall we say? Do you want to call them tawdry?
Tawdry, sure. Let's go with tawdry. That's your word, not mine. And I would think that there might be a certain amount of hesitation on your part. And there might be a certain amount of, what will the family say? Did you deal with that? Did you have to say to yourself, you've done it again, Sarah?
No, I think basically, what you have to do when I think you write anything, and certainly when you write comedy, is you have to think about, you think about an audience insofar as you're writing it for an audience, and you want it to feel funny and generous in that way, so that it doesn't feel like this is, especially when you write nonfiction and you're writing about yourself, you don't want it to feel like, who cares about what this nobody went through? Do you know what I mean? So you're trying, right. You're thinking about an audience insofar as I want people to be entertained so that it can be for an audience and not just some stupid self-obsessed exercise. I don't know if I succeeded in that, but that is certainly the goal. But then past that point, you kind of then have to forget that anybody will ever look at it other than you. And it's just about, as a comedian, going, what do I find funny? And what is interesting to me? And what do I think is honest and real and relatable for people? And even if it's embarrassing, even if it's ridiculous, if it's just you sitting alone in your apartment for a month while you try and hammer out a chapter and think, how do I make this subject seem funny instead of just stupid? Again, not saying I ever succeed in that, but that's always the project. Over the course of that time, you forget that there'll be a time 2 years later when you're doing a radio interview and someone's sort of like, how were you able to talk about that? And you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, because you just sort of turn off the part of your brain that remembers that you'll ever have to.
You've done a lot of work with The Moth.
Yes.
Did you get the chance to try some of these out on a live audience so that you could hear the gasps, hear the people say, oh, did she really just reveal that? Anything like that?
Interestingly, so some of the stuff that I think you might be referring to, mm-hmm. No, I never talk about that on stage because I'm not that strong, and I wish I was, and I wish that more women could and did, but it's kind of a final frontier. You can tell dirty sex stories and you can do all that, but when it gets into some bathroom business, it's like women just don't do it. And I wish that I was brave enough, and I never have been. And it's part of why I really wanted to write about it, because I felt like this stuff is very human. And I do feel the need to say, I know that it's sort of the attention getting part of the book, but it's also, some of this stuff is maybe in total 20 pages out of a 307 page book. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't think it's sort of, all I want to do is talk about being in the bathroom.
Right.
But I did talk about that stuff again in total, maybe over the course of probably more 15 pages. But I felt like, yeah, that stuff that's interesting and it's real and I think it's funny and I don't have the cojones, as they say, to talk about it on stage. So with the distance that you get as a writer and the kind of privacy to work something out, I made a choice to write about it. And then there's some other stuff that I would try out on stage and be, to try and get a sense of whether or not it has the potential to be entertaining. And it's funny because some stuff that can really work on a stage when you have the power of your personality and your timing and a funny nudge, nudge, wink, wink, stuff can really work that way. And then you write it down and you're like, this is the most boring thing I've ever written ever. So a lot of that stuff, there's, I think, a little less overlap in those departments than I would have originally thought there might be.
I want to go on record as saying I wasn't offended by it. I was laughing. And so, yeah, it wasn't a moment where I thought that you shouldn't have broached the topics that you did. I found them very funny, but I'm not the kind of person, I think, either, that would have been comfortable sharing that. But now that you've, gone that direction, that's all I'm going to write about for the next several days. Is just,
right, it's all you have to express creatively from this.
My thanks to my guests, P.J. O'Rourke, Dan Wilber, Andrew Hudgens, Sarah Barron, Jim C. Hines, and Tony Cochran. The full versions of my interviews can be found at craftheshow.com, along with book giveaways. And don't forget that every Wednesday at 8 p.m., you can tune in for excerpts of Craft. This is Doug Dangler. Be creative.